This podcast is brought to you by DIA, the trusted global neutral forum for healthcare product development professionals. DIA, driving insights to action.
Today, the topic is pain. Pain, both chronic and acute, is a widespread, serious condition. According to an analysis by the National Institutes of Health, more than 25 million people suffer from chronic pain in the U.S. alone. Both chronic pain and post-surgical pain are frequently managed with a variety of opioid drugs. But all too often, these treatments are only partially effective, lead to serious side effects, and present the risk of misuse and addiction. The World Health Organization estimates that worldwide, more than 15 million people suffer from opioid dependence, and roughly 69,000 people die from opioid overdoses each year. As opioid use has increased and opioid abuse and addiction have turned into a serious societal concern, it appears that lack of adequate training among healthcare professionals on the proper use of opioid drugs for the alleviation of pain contributes to the problem. Scientists and healthcare professionals are looking for new approaches to pain management that incorporate quality of life measures for the patient, provide better professional training, and could reduce or even eliminate the need for opioids. I am Alberto Grignolo, editor of DIA Global Forum. Today, my guest is Edward Bilski, an expert in opioid pharmacology and early-stage drug development, who serves as the provost and chief academic officer at Pacific Northwest University of Health Sciences in Yakima, Washington. His research focuses on opioid pharmacology, securing over $10 million of extramural funding and publishing over 80 peer-reviewed publications. Professor Bilski is co-founder of two biotechnology companies, one of which brought a neutral opioid antagonist into clinical trials as a novel approach to reduce opioid side effects. As a medical educator, Professor Bilski engages various audiences on topics related to pain, interdisciplinary pain management, and addiction that better prepare healthcare professionals for managing these challenging conditions. He joins us today to discuss the importance of engaging patients and other stakeholders in the management of pain and to share his perspectives on alternative treatments for pain. Professor Bilski, it's a pleasure to be with you today. Thank you for joining us and welcome.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Let's start with the challenges. Where do we currently face the greatest obstacles to alleviating the burden of chronic pain and opioid overuse?
The first thing is the sheer number of people that are affected or impacted by chronic pain. The numbers are, like you said, are staggering. And you know, every one of those patients has a kind of an individual thumbprint or profile that they bring, including all the different comorbidities that can be almost as challenging as the primary disease in terms of its management. These are complex chronic diseases, both chronic pain and the substance use disorders. So when you have chronic conditions like this, there's a lot of nuance and a lot of areas where there's some uncertainties in the treatment algorithms, and we need more research to kind of fill those gaps of knowledge in. I think we have limited drug options for broad spectrum analgesics. I think we've got a lot of different classes of drugs that we can bring to the table, but none of them are as broad spectrum as the opioids. And I think that has contributed to maybe an over-reliance on the opioid class of drugs for the treatment of severe chronic pain. Education, I think, is a challenge that we have underemphasized educating future prescribers, whether they're medical students, physician assistant students, or nurse practitioners that are in training, along with other healthcare professionals and the challenges around managing chronic pain. It's really underemphasized in curriculum. You know, I think there's also some challenges in the healthcare industry that don't reward or incentivize integrated care. We need to do a better job of taking multiple modalities, pharmacological and non-pharmacological, and incorporating them into standard practice and allowing the practitioners the time and the resources to fully implement these things, monitor them over time, change as needed on the fly, you know, with input from the patients. So all of this together makes chronic pain a very challenging disease to manage.
You mentioned that training has not emphasized adequately the use and abuse of opioids. I suppose you mean medical school training, residency training. Is that correct?
Yeah, and I would expand that to the other healthcare professions too, that just pain, for whatever reason, has been underemphasized. And I think there's some good, you know, studies that have quantified in the medical school curricula how very little formal training medical students get before they go on to residency, much less than veterinarians, for example, that are treating and managing pain in animals. But we've still got an uphill battle in a very full set of curricula, whether it's a medical school program or a PharmD or a nursing program. There's a lot of competing needs and interests in the curricula. So we have to not only just add hours, but figure out how to have the delivery of the curricula very efficient so that it has a lasting impact on what ultimately is going to be a lifelong learner.
But why this lack of emphasis? Is it because the opioid crisis and abuse is a recent revelation, if you will, that it comes as a surprise to medical schools and training programs?
One of the things that it suffers from is the stigmas associated with mental health and areas of mental health, including chronic pain and the comorbidities that are associated with it, including anxiety, depression, and our limited understanding of arguably the most complex organ that we have, the brain. And brain is makes us, you know, what it is to be a human being. And, you know, until recently, we were way behind in goals of brain research and the full realization of the technologies that were necessary to probe this incredibly complex, you know, organ. And so that, I think, makes us, when we go into the practice of medicine, more tentative. And you add in the stigmatization that occurs typically with diseases that affect the nervous system, conspires to kind of make people want to underemphasize it or shy away from it. And, you know, we suffered from that for many decades. It's only until recently that we've become more comfortable talking about these issues and directing resources and advance the science and our understanding of these systems.
Let's turn to the patient. Of course, the patient is the stakeholder that has the pain and also the stakeholder that eventually becomes opioid dependent. And so there is a positive side to pain management. There's obviously a dark side to pain management, namely abuse. So the question is, how could healthcare providers, when properly trained, bring the patient voice more effectively into discussions about managing pain and about the risks of opioid abuse?
I think it starts initially with the interaction between the patient and the provider, getting an accurate history, gaining the trust of the patient so that the patient's going to be volunteering, you know, sometimes very private information. And again, with conditions such as chronic pain, there may be some stigma that has to be overcome to be able to then have that honest discussion. When the patient trusts the provider and shares that background and the current status of their health, that allows the provider to come up with, in collaboration with the person, a treatment plan. And then that's going to have to be monitored. Progress or lack of progress has to be noted. Trial and error. Even though we have practice guidelines and algorithms that in evidence-based medicine that helps guide us, you still have that individual sitting in front of you. And, you know, we would love to have some more definitive biomarkers that can help monitor progress and side effects and whatnot, but that's incomplete. So we have to rely also on what that patient or that person is telling us. So that's an imprecise science, but it's vital to, you know, a successful outcome. Setting realistic goals, understanding the patient's situation and what they can afford and what they're willing to try. How far-ranging are their goals? Small successes along the way and incentivizing it so the patient, you know, continues to work towards their health. The patient's commitment to the treatment plan. And if you could put some of their anxieties at rest, you know, saying, I'm going to stick with you, I'm going to work with you, I'm going to try to incorporate all the different modalities and technologies that are available to us to try to bring you to a state of health or to minimize the impact of this chronic disease on your life and well-being. That patient trusts that provider and, you know, is willing to work that much harder too. So this is a symbiotic relationship between them. Now, you can expand that by having more formal feedback from patient advocacy groups. You know, sometimes the patient with the chronic disease is feeling like they're not a real effective spokesperson to champion reform in how we approach something. That's where, you know, again, finding that inner voice and making them feel like their opinions are valued and they can contribute to these outcomes, you know, successful outcomes, empowers them and is part of advancing the field.
Now, we live in a society where many people want to solve their problems, particularly health problems, by simply taking the pill and the problem goes away. How can a healthcare provider, when sitting down with a patient who has been suffering from chronic pain, perhaps for months and years, how can the healthcare provider say, no, Mr. Smith, no, Mrs. Jones, I'm not going to give you opioids. We'll need to find another way around that. Is that a difficult conversation these days? Is it a possible conversation? Is it becoming an easier conversation given the general awareness of the opioid crisis?
Yes, I don't know if it's any easier. It may be more difficult as these things hit the media, and sometimes the media sensationalizes it. And we tend to, as a society, be, one, very polarized in our approaches, and then two, we tend to oscillate to the extremes where we're over or under prescribing something or doing something to one extreme and then bouncing back to the other extreme when we find that it may not be working optimally. So, you know, I kind of try to stress balance. If you start with a foundation of trust and understanding of what the goal setting or the goals are for the near and long term, and work from there to come up with strategies to meet some kind of midterm goals, taking away some of the fear and anxiety that patient has, particularly the one that has, you know, been in significant pain for months to years, and maybe questioning, am I ever going to feel better? Am I ever going to be able to do the things that I once was able to do? Then you'll have a better chance of starting to talk about their specific current treatment regimen and whether it's working fully, partially, or not at all, and how you might now approach it differently, combining different tools that are available, understanding that every treatment carries some risk associated with it, some more than others, trying to do some best practices, you know, which the Centers for Disease Control and some of the pain societies have published extensively on, and how we're going to navigate those protocols and best practices, but also rely upon the experience of the practitioner and the feedback that they're getting from the patient. I think that helps put the patient at ease and kind of engenders that.
Is there a problem in patients basically being refused opioids by one healthcare provider and then going to another one hoping to be prescribed an opioid to address their pain? Does that happen, the shopping around?
Yes, definitely the shopping around happens, and there are practitioners that are not practicing good medicine by indiscriminately prescribing to anyone and everyone. And we certainly have extremes where people are gaming the system or prescribing just basically for profit. Unfortunately, those extreme cases, those are what stick in people's mind and the press reports. And it hurts both practitioners and people with the chronic disease in that it makes them harder to do their jobs or to get the treatments that they need. There are certain individuals, based on their medical histories and the physical exams and other information available, that will be candidates. But, you know, first you're probably going to want to try other things that don't have the risks that the opioids have. The person that's been on opioids for some time, you know, you certainly still need to reassess, are they truly effective? Are they just masking or blunting something? Do we have control of some of the other comorbidities that might be escalating or enhancing the levels of pain? You know, a good example would be the sleep-wake cycle. You'd have to do a thorough assessment of the patient and how much sleep they're getting and if it's disrupted. Certainly can be disrupted by the pain. Opioids can have some effect on that. And we know that that's a stressor when you're not getting enough sleep, maybe a sleep hygiene study or assessment to try to get that under control, and then maybe try to get some of the anxiety under control. And then we might, you know, find that we might be able to manage the pain without necessarily turning to the opioid class of agents.
For post-surgical acute pain, it might make sense to administer an opioid for a very short period of time, maybe a day or two, and then migrate a patient to something else, non-opioid. But for chronic pain, does it make sense to try an opioid for a short time and then switch the patient off? Or is that really all or none? I mean, either you put somebody on opioids and they stay on them, or you don't and you use alternatives. How do you compare acute versus chronic pain in this regard?
For a new case of chronic pain, let's say it's been escalating or not well controlled for a month or so, the patient is presenting to the provider, and, you know, again, a good thorough assessment of what's contributing to the pain, what makes it worse, are there some non-pharmacological or early stage pharmacological interventions that we can try before we turn to the opioids? That's a very different patient population than some group that has been having significant chronic pain for, say, a year or more, mm-hmm. and might be receiving opioids currently, maybe with some perceived or actual benefit, but also some concerns around side effects ranging from the effects on the gastrointestinal system to all the way up through substance, you know, misuse, abuse, addiction. And you got to do a thorough assessment of both the benefits of this current therapy and the liabilities, and then come up with, you know, a treatment plan along with continuous monitoring. And that's the other key challenge. Each patient is different. Can they get to their provider or their specialist on a monthly basis? Will their insurance cover these repeat visits? Again, the broader challenge of how do we manage effectively chronic diseases in a variety of different healthcare systems.
Let's come to alternatives to opioids. In recent years, and you know this better than I, scientists have increasingly focused on the pathology of pain and addiction to help identify potential alternative treatments. So what are some of the most promising preclinical and maybe clinical findings on the alternatives to opioids?
There's a number of different classes of drugs that could be considered analgesic. You know, some of the mainstream ones would be, you know, the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs or drug like acetaminophen, Tylenol. You've got other classes of drugs that may be labeled as antidepressants, but have some efficacy in certain types of pain states, the older tricyclic antidepressants and some of the newer dual-acting agents are cleaner on some of the receptor systems. You've got the drugs that kind of have anti-epileptic or anti-seizure activities. You certainly have some niche products or applications, you know, some of the local anesthetics and creams and ointments or injections. You've got some drugs that can be delivered through pumps directly into the nervous system. There's active areas of basic science research trying to further understand the normal pain processing signals that occur, how they can get derailed in a pathology and contribute to chronic pain, and can we target these effectively without too many undue side effects. What makes the opioids so effective is that they are in multiple levels of the pain pathways and the processing and the regulation, the modulation, and our perception of the pain. And so it's unlikely that we will find medications that are such broad spectrum as the opioids. And we got to figure out in our healthcare system, can we incentivize and develop new drugs that might have a much more limited application for the patient, but give that specific population significant relief without the liabilities of the opioid class? As you go from the pharmacological to the non-pharmacological, under certain conditions, it's definitely appropriate for a procedure. It could be a surgical intervention. Could be an implantation of a device, all the way to manual manipulative therapy, out to things like exercise. We know exercise, when it can be tolerated and built into a daily or weekly regimen, is very effective for at least lowering some of the burden of pain. You certainly have the effects and the impact of a placebo effect too. And that's not something to discount or to minimize. Placebo effect is still a real effect. And you know, how do we incorporate that? Just patient support groups have value. Is that a placebo effect or is that just wiring into our nervous systems that we want to typically be around people? When pain isolates us and prevents us from having normal relationships, that probably does a lot more harm than good. And the converse, if we can incorporate back into our lifestyles, normal conversations, having goals, being able to get out of bed, get out of the house, and interact with people. That's a form of therapy. And we know through, you know, some of the support groups that this is another modality that doesn't cost a lot of money. It's how do you bring that patient step by step back into that, what we would consider that state of health.
Pain would seem to be an area amenable to the benefits of precision medicine. For instance, if you and I both have a headache, I might take acetaminophen and it'll go away. You might take acetaminophen and it doesn't. Ibuprofen may work better for you than it does for me. Is science any closer to establishing the different individual etiologies of pain, such as to be able to apply more precise interventions to individual patients? Are genetics playing a role? Yes. Genomics going to somehow contribute to better understanding and better management of individual pain in individual patients?
The short answer is yes, that there's definitely a lot of progress being made, and it's requiring the synthesis of many different disciplines and fields and being able to handle the very large data sets and then drilling that down to practical approaches that are going to help that individual patient and optimize treatment regimen. I think, you know, there's some classic examples of pharmacokinetics, pharmacogenomics. You know, the case of codeine, for example, there's a subset of patients who don't demethylate it into morphine. For them, codeine is basically ineffectual. Are you going to pay for a screening of those patients, or would you just on the fly say, okay, I'm not getting a response with codeine, I'm going to try a different opioid? I think it gets interesting, probably not just genetics, but you know, that the proteomics and the circuitry that's involved. from a very personal standpoint, both my parents have had bouts of chronic pain. And my father has been kind of a perfect case study of where he's got a connected and involved primary care physician, along with a pain specialist who has been incredibly patient and engaged with my father in trying to get him better. My father's now in his 90s, and he had tried many different modalities to manage his back pain, and with mostly unsuccessful. He went through many different regimens of opioid therapy, including dose escalations and trying different opioids in different routes of administration. And it was either a lack of efficacy or too many side effects by that particular opioid. And just out of trial and error, they put him on a course of a drug called levorphanol, which is an older opioid that's got some unique pharmacodynamic properties. And for whatever reason, that gave him, at a pretty modest dose, good efficacy without too many side effects. It took some time to get him at the right dose level. Again, they were being very conservative given his age, but it was a successful outcome. And along with allowing my dad to go back to the gym a few times a week and to live in his own home, that has a very strong motivating factor for my dad to be engaged in this healthcare plan. And having these physicians who were very much invested in him and listening to him and trusting him led to, I think, a very successful outcome.
But what you had described, which is good news, is nevertheless a trial and error process of getting to a drug that actually benefited him, right? So question is, going forward, are we going to be able to be more precise about it and, based on patient characteristics, identify the right drug immediately or in a very, very short time, avoiding the trial and error cycles, which could take weeks and months?
Exactly. And that whatever percentage of pain management can successfully be managed with a particular drug regimen, and that percent that influences the choice of one drug or set of drugs over another set, that's the holy grail. And the faster we get to that successful management, the better.
Are we progressing at a reasonable speed towards that holy grail?
I think we'd all like to be there faster than we currently are. I understand how complex these systems are when we talk about just simple genetics or genomics, and then bring in proteomics, and then bring in the nervous system. And it is daunting, but we're chipping away at that with really strong fundamental basic science research, both on the technique side and what we're able to now ask in terms of fundamental questions, the data gathering and the data processing, and then bringing in from the animal models into the clinical models. Enormous costs associated with this. And we're also talking about chronic diseases that could be years to decades of a person's life, and how to continue to successfully monitor that. But I feel like we are at the cusp of really impacting this. And maybe an analogy would be to the cancer field, where it's taken decades and billions of dollars of research, but we're now starting to individualize therapies right from the get-go, both in the diagnostic phase and the treatment phase. Some huge advances that have contributed to longer lives and higher quality of life, or even just cancer-free cure of cancer because of these technologies. So pain is going to, because of the investments that we've started to make and hopefully will continue to make, benefit from this, along with many of the other mental health diseases and disorders.
Back in 2014, you received the Patient Advocacy Award from the American Academy of Pain Medicine. Congratulations. What aspects of your work impact patients most directly? Maybe you can share a success story with us.
I am a basic scientist by training, and seen from the very early stages of my career a success. I was fortunate to be part of a set of investigations at the basic science level that were looking at the opioid systems in relationship to ingested behaviors. And the mentor I had, Dr. Larry Reed, he was investigating the potential application of opiate antagonists for alcoholism. So I came in at the tail end of the basic science work that he was laying down this framework, and then seeing a set of physicians who took this into the clinical trials, and then very soon thereafter led to the approval of naltrexone for a subset of alcoholism that would be combined with other non-pharmacological modalities, and that it would help certain patients, and it has successfully helped. So that showed me two things. It showed me why we invest in basic science research and translational research with a definite set of goals in mind that are going to benefit the patient and the public, but also that this type of work takes decades. So I continue to maintain a scientific research program and brought one particular drug into clinical trials. Mm-hmm. I know how hard it is and how difficult it is to be successful at that. And ultimately, a product is even more challenging. So I take solace in the fact that I can also have some contributions almost immediately. And when we talk about the training of a medical student or other healthcare professional, these could be 2 to 4 year programs that lead to lifelong learners who stay up on the latest literature. They understand the complexities of these chronic diseases, the nuances, the best approaches, but also the importance of having good listening abilities and relationships with their patients that lead to a more engaged set of interactions that increase the likelihood of a successful outcome. That is a very satisfying part of my role as a medical educator. And then more recently in my career, I've had the luxury of being able to, and the willingness to kind of try something different. And that had to do with realizing that over the 20 plus years I was in the basic science laboratory, I'd never had a meaningful conversation with someone in chronic pain. And maybe that's not that atypical of PhDs, that we get wrapped up in our science and we think we're leading towards a cure or a new treatment for a challenging disease, but we don't know. Maybe we went into the PhD route rather than the MD or DO route because we weren't comfortable with talking to people with serious chronic illnesses. And as I realized that if I was going to be, you know, informed and adequately trained, I needed to bring this component into my professional life. I had that willingness and willing to take that risk, you know, that some trepidation when I returned some phone calls of some people that were interested in the work that we were doing and had chronic pain. And all of a sudden, I had this revitalization of my career. And these were amazing individuals, human beings that had enormous challenges placed in front of them, sometimes damaged the nervous system, sometimes an unknown etiology that escalated. And this has really informed my thinking, and I think has helped me become an advocate for them. Sometimes they feel that stigma, and they don't think that they can be an effective spokesperson, so they need some venues. And what we found was this kind of wraps back into medical education. We very quickly involved our medical students in this initiative and then other healthcare professional students that we were working with. They started to go to chronic pain support group meetings, and they started to build relationships with the individuals. And learning communication skills, power of observation, and just showing empathy and seeing that as a form of therapy was eye-opening to them and reinforced for those that were going to go on to be practitioners why they were getting into it in the first place. It's related into some of our outreach into K through 12 school systems where we teach about brain safety and brain awareness. It connects in with public events. We're communicating with the public and we're talking to legislators at the state and federal levels, work with our professional societies. And it's extended now into working with young people in recovery too, which those two groups, the people with chronic pain and the people with substance use disorders, have been pointing their fingers at each other, blaming each other for this opioid crisis. And when you take that step back and you listen to them and you look at it objectively, these two populations have more in common than they have apart. And if they work together, they're going to have a stronger voice in making changes in our healthcare system that will be to the benefit of themselves, but also will, I think, reduce the burden of disease socially and economically, as well as improve the quality of life of these individuals. So that is one of the most rewarding aspects of my job.
Thousands of members of DIA work in clinical research, regulatory affairs, and associated fields. I would like to ask you, how can these people help overcome this healthcare crisis?
Definitely getting more engaged and involved. And when I say that, we can sometimes drill down to the very specifics of our primary job and into infinitesimal levels. And to some extent, that depth is important as roles in science or in other aspects of our jobs over the drug approval process. We need specialists, but we need to also sometimes get our heads out of our desks and our offices and our industry and look at what is a more broad and challenging set of problems and kind of see how they interrelate and help to contribute to comprehensive solutions. So, you know, for me, it was, yes, I was a scientist and a medical educator, but to be most effective, I needed to understand aspects of healthcare delivery. So talking to physicians and other practitioners, talking to insurers, talking to public health people, and really importantly, talking to the individuals that were impacted by the chronic pain and seeing the challenges that they face. Also, at the community level, we started to realize that there was a lot of resources that were available, but each individual didn't know about many of the other resources, and they didn't know how to combine the resources to maximize efficiency. So at that systems level, whether it's a drug approval process or a public health management process, if we as individual stakeholders have that broader appreciation, I think we're going to have better dialogue. We're going to have fresher ideas of how to approach this. We're going to be able to, willing to take some risk and trying some new things out. And I think some of them will be very successful.
That's a very positive message. And let me close by thanking you, Professor Bilski, for your insights, for sharing your experience. And you've obviously thought very deeply about this important societal issue. Thank you very much for joining us and being with us today.
Well, I appreciate both you and DIA to allow me to have the forum, and really look forward to additional discussions on this topic.
For DIA Global Forum, I am Alberto Grignolo.
To learn more about this topic, visit us online at diaglobal.org.